I know that we have some guests here, and if you have a church, that's great. You know, our job wasn't to, our goal here wasn't to get everyone who has another church to leave their church and come to our church. It's that we want to be equipping Christians anywhere in the kingdom for ministry in the kingdom. And part of that is an ability to think through challenges to the faith, thinking through things that we're told that, you know, this is the way it is by the world. And our topic for tonight, intelligent design, which speaks to the issue of evolution, which we're told this is the way it is. And so we wanting to equip everyone for the ability to think through these issues and to be able to maybe answer challenges within your own circles, or even to not fall prey to faulty thinking as you're confronted with things that we don't believe are true. If you are a guest and you do not have a church, we'd love to have you. Our services are 10 a.m. Or even if you do have a church, you're welcome to join us. We're not trying to steal you from your churches. But our services are 10 a.m. Sunday mornings, and we preach on the gospel, but our Sunday school and different things, you know, we really try to get people to thinking about the faith, to thinking about theology, thinking about the things that we believe, thinking about the challenges that are thrown at us. And so we're deeply committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to transforming our minds and building up our minds so that we can adequately think through these issues. And we're very, very pleased to have Alan with us, coming all the way from San Diego, California, to be with us, and most recently coming from Beirut. Is that right? You're in Beirut, doing some training with Focus on the Family there. So he's traveled the world over, and now he's in little old Petoskey here with us. And we're very happy to have you. So, Alan, thank you.
Well, good evening. Good evening. Good to see those of you again who were here this morning. You know, actually, there was a number of people who were asking about my name, Schliemann, and they were looking at me and wondering about, you know, whether I'm Middle Eastern or what's the story with that. The name Schliemann actually means Solomon, and so most people actually, when they see me, they think I'm perhaps Jewish, and of course, Solomon being a very Jewish name. My first name, Alan, and my middle name is Yaku, and that's another word for Jacob. So Alan Jacob Solomon, it's a very Jewish name. But in reality, I'm not Jewish. I'm what's known as an Assyrian. Now, how many have ever heard of Assyrians? Okay, yeah, so most of you. So if you're familiar with your Old Testament history, you'll probably recall the Assyrians are spoken a lot about. Unfortunately for me, the Assyrians were the bad guys, right? You know, they're the sworn enemies of Israel and consequently the sworn enemies of God. And so that was kind of a bummer growing up and having your parents tell you, yeah, our people are in the Bible, but guess what? It's not good news. You know, in fact, the whole book of Nahum in the Old Testament is a prophecy about how God's going to wipe out the entire Assyrian nation. And of course, if you know anything about history, you know that in the 6th century B.C., the Assyrian empire was destroyed. And, you know, the reason why they were so hated by Israel and by actually many of the people that lived near them was because they were just extremely brutal in warfare. And in fact, you know, not only did they just attack people like, you know, any kind of enemy would, but we would like chop off people's heads. We would gouge out their eyes. We would skin them alive. We would take their dead bodies. We'd hang them on spears, light them on fire so that they would serve as light for our parties in the evening. But we're a lot nicer now. In fact, you know, if you talk to me, you'll see that I'm very friendly. I haven't hurt anyone today. I spent most of the day with Father Mike, and I haven't hurt anyone, so be of good cheer. We have turned from our wicked ways. Well, tonight we'll be talking about the topic of intelligent design, and really this is a discussion about a simple question. And that question is everything that we see in the world today in terms of in the biological realm, that which is part of the plant kingdom and as well as the animal kingdom, is everything that we see in the biological realm the product of a blind, random, and chance process like evolution? Or is what we see in the biological realm more likely the result of an intelligent designer? Was there some sort of mind who fashioned or who planned what we see in biology? And so before I address specifically the issue of intelligent design, what I want to do is just back up a little bit and speak to the issue of evolution just broadly. We won't go into a lot of detail, but I want to give you a little information about what evolution is, define some of its terms, and then just give a quick overview of why I'm not an evolutionist in terms of why I think the evidence for evolution is lacking to warrant belief, and then kind of provide an argument or a case in the second half of this evening's program as to why I think intelligent design makes better sense, actually, of the scientific evidence. So first, I want to begin, though, with what I think is an important thing to do, and that is simply to define evolution and the way it's used. In fact, many times, and by the way, if you have notes or if you have your handout, you'll see that I'll be following along in this outline pretty closely to it. But when you see the word evolution used in either scholarly journals and scientific papers, or even if you hear it spoken about in a textbook or in a classroom, different definitions of evolution are being used. And it's critical, literally critical, to understand the different ways in which the word evolution is defined. And so there's three primary definitions that we see. The first one for evolution, the first definition, is simply change over time. Change over time. And when you think about evolution and being defined as this way, this is obviously not controversial, is it? Right? I mean, even as Christians of any stripe, we could all be certainly affirming of the idea of evolution being simply change over time. Because on this definition, everything evolves, right? Cities evolve. Our theology evolves. This carpet probably evolves over time as it gets stepped on and changes, right? If you're in school, your GPA probably evolves. Hopefully evolves up and not down, but you know, regardless, everything evolves. And so on this definition, this is no big deal. And so really we shouldn't have any kind of a major concern about evolution when it's defined this way. Now, there's another way that evolution is often defined, and I like to refer to it as microevolution. I know that scientists balk at this title, and that's fine. I'm not so concerned about what the title is. But the concept is present because this is something that Charles Darwin, in his book On the Origin of Species, taught about. And so sometimes evolution is defined as microevolution. And if it's a little bit small in print there, basically what it says is that there are small changes that take place in nature, in different species, over time, and these changes produce new characteristics. So this is also similar to the idea of natural selection, where you have a particular species, and perhaps through genetic mutation, its offspring has some sort of new feature, new characteristic. And if that new characteristic allows that particular species to survive better in this environment, then of course that new characteristic will be incorporated into future generations. And this is natural selection. And those species members of the species that don't have that genetic mutation will probably die off because it doesn't provide an advantage for that organism's survival. This is the idea of natural selection. But even microevolution really isn't controversial, even as a Christian, because we see examples of microevolution every day in our lives. For example, how many of you have ever gone to the doctor and have to take antibiotics, and the doctor tells you something about what you're supposed to do with those antibiotics? And what's the key thing they always tell you to do?
Take them all,
that's right. And does anybody know why they tell you to take all of your antibiotics and to not stop even if you feel better? Does anybody know what the rationale is? Yeah?
Because you need to have full course in order to be sure the germs are killed.
That's right. Exactly, that's right. You need to take the full course of the antibiotics to ensure that all the bacteria are killed. Because if not, if you sort of stop perhaps a week before you've taken the whole course, what can happen is some of these bacteria survive. They're not killed, even though you might feel better. And then they adapt, they evolve, and they develop a resistance to that bacteria. And so now they start to grow, and when you start taking that antibiotic again, the antibiotic is not effective, because the bacteria have undergone a microevolutionary change. And so evolutionists throughout the world often cite examples like this. But again, this is not controversial, right? I mean, we see this happen before our very eyes. Another common example that's cited, is there's a picture there, is of these birds, these finches. And you'll notice that they have different sizes and shapes of beaks. Now, these particular finches were studied on the Galapagos Islands, where Charles Darwin actually did a lot of his field work. And what they've noticed is that during seasons of drought, certain kinds of nuts become more rare, and other kinds of nuts, which are a lot harder to break and much larger, become more common. And the birds that have the larger beaks are able to crack the nuts, get at the food, and survive. The finches with smaller beaks can't break the nuts, so they tend to die off. And so after a few generations of finches, the average size of the finch beak becomes larger because the ones with the more advantageous characteristics survive through natural selection. And so this is often referred to as an evolutionary change. And of course, when they say the term evolutionary change in this example, they're talking about a microevolutionary change, a small change taking place within a species that leads to a new characteristic. Okay? And again, this is not a controversial thing. We see this happen before our eyes. There's nothing concerning about it. In fact, even as Bible-believing Christians, we believe that Adam and Eve had a certain height, had a certain skin complexion, perhaps had certain hair color. And now, flash forward, you know, thousands of years later, we now see the wide diversity of different ethnicities around the planet. We see African Americans, we see Chinese, we see Scandinavians, we see you know, every kind of group with different complexions, different hair color, different sizes. And so this is a microevolutionary change. It's a single species, the human species, but yet we see quite a lot of diversity amongst this one species. Again, small changes taking place within a species that leads to new characteristics. And so when evolutionists cite microevolutionary changes in textbooks, this shouldn't be worrisome to us. However, there's a third type of evolution, or a third type of definition that is often offered for evolution, and this is known as macroevolution, or at least amongst those of us who study this particular issue, we call it macroevolution. And macroevolution is simply an extrapolation of microevolution so that it can explain how all of life emerged. In other words, those same small changes that are occurring in a species, if you just allow those changes to continue over millions and millions of years, you will have the transformation of one species to another, so it is alleged. And this would be considered a macroevolutionary change. Macroevolution also is how we would best perhaps describe Darwinian evolution. This is the idea that the more controversial theory that Darwin had, that species can literally change over time to another species entirely. Now, it's important to recognize that macroevolution, or Darwinian evolution, involves only natural, physical, and observable processes. Meaning it's a blind process, there's no foresight, it's not like there's anyone guiding this process to make certain kinds of species. It is random, it's driven by random mutations in the genetic code, and it's driven largely by chance. Now the reason I point this out is because sometimes there's people, there's Christians, who say, well, you know, I believe in evolution. I believe evolution happened, but God guided the process. And this we call theistic evolution. Now, there might be some of you in here, actually, that adopt this theory, and that's fine. I'm not here to try to talk you out of it at this point. But I will say this, that on a Darwinian account, this is not a valid understanding of Darwin's theory of evolution. Okay? In other words, true evolutionists would reject that as a legitimate understanding of evolutionary theory. Because the whole purpose of evolutionary theory was to account for how all of life emerged without appealing to God. And so the instant you say, well, evolution happened, but God did it, well, this isn't evolution anymore, this is creationism. Now again, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, I'm just simply saying if this is your view, you have to recognize that evolutionists do not consider this as a legitimate understanding of Darwinian theory. Okay, so keep that in mind. Any questions about the definitions so far that I've offered? Because understanding these definitions is critical to this next step. Any comments, concerns? So far, so good? Okay, so the question then is, why do I even bring this up? Why define evolution? Why is this so important? Well, here's the reason. Most examples that I see in scholarly literature or even in popular literature and biology textbooks are examples of microevolution, and those are used as evidence that macroevolution occurred. In other words, they cite these small changes that we see every day, like it with antibiotic resistance of bacteria, or with the variation of the size of a finch beak. And they say, this same process that we see, look, it's happening before us. Evolution is occurring. Therefore, their conclusion, macroevolution is true. This whole idea that life began with a single cell, evolved into, you know, multicellular organisms, eventually into fish, eventually into amphibians, you know, reptiles, birds, animals, mammals, and humans, and all that stuff. That whole story, which is a macroevolutionary story, is often supported by examples of microevolution. And that's why I'm saying it's critical to make sure that when you're reading the word evolution or evolutionary changes or whatever, you ask the question, what kind of evolution are they talking about? How are they defining evolution? Because if you think about this, microevolution might demonstrate how to modify an existing organ or body part, like that of of the beak of a finch. But that same process does not explain how beaks arose in the first place, right? I mean, microevolutionary changes, like developing a resistance to antibiotics, might explain how certain bacteria develop a resistance to that, but they don't explain how bacteria emerged in the first place. Or they don't explain how birds or finches arose in the first place. And this is precisely what needs to be explained. In fact, if you, the National Academy of Sciences is probably one of the most powerful scientific organizations in the country. Of course, they are radically pro-evolution. And they have a guidebook that they issue out to teachers and to other kinds of curriculum coordinators around the country that teaches people how to teach on evolution and respond to wacko Christians who don't agree with evolution. And this is precisely the purpose of this guidebook. How do you teach evolution and how do you prove it? And the book, when you read through it, the vast majority of examples that they cite for evolution, for macroevolution, are microevolutionary or just simply change over time types of examples. Let me give you some exact quotes. So page 11 of the guidebook, and I had to write them down and I apologize, I forgot to bring the guidebook with me. I brought something else, but here's page 11. I'm going to read to you the quote, and you tell me which definition of evolution they're using. Is it change over time? Is it microevolution or is it macroevolution? So here's page 11, says this. The world around us changes. This simple fact is obvious everywhere we look. Mammals now live in a world that was once dominated by reptilian giants such as Tyrannosaurus rex. So what kind of definition are they offering here?
Change
over time, right? They're saying the world changes around us. Okay, no one should disagree with this. Page 17, here's another citation of evidence for evolution. And again, they say evolution, but they don't define which kind of evolution. They say evolution by natural selection still operates today. For example, the continual evolution of human pathogens has come to pose one of the most serious public health problems now facing human societies. Many strains of bacteria have become increasingly resistant to once effective antibiotics, as natural selection has amplified resistant strains that arose through naturally occurring genetic variation. Microevolution, exactly. Page 55. Evolution, in the broadest sense, explains that what we see today is different from what existed in the past. Galaxies, stars, the solar system, and the Earth have changed through time, and so has life on Earth. Change over time. Page 17, the North American lacewing species separated from a common ancestor species recently in evolutionary time and are very similar. But they are different in color, reflecting their different habitats, and they breed at different times of the year. Well, it's microevolution because it's saying now these different species have different colors and they breed at different times. And so. Well, true, but the species itself is different. So, because some of them breed at a different time of the year than others. And again, these aren't controversial, right? And so their goal, what they're trying to say is, look, you see evolution happening within our own lives. Therefore, macroevolution, that big story that Darwin gave about how life arose from a single cell and evolved, is true. But you see how these examples over here of microevolution or change over time do not sufficiently account for why we should think macroevolution is true. There was actually I just picked up on my flight here from San Diego to to Detroit, Discovery Magazine has a special issue on evolution. Okay, so of course Discovery is a well-known scientific pro-evolution organization. And so I decided to flip through it and just kind of read through all the articles to see what kind of evidence they offer to demonstrate to us that evolution is true. And sure enough, same kinds of things. I even underlined them when I was in the airplane. Here it says, so they're saying, the reality is that evolution is very much a work in progress, and its awesome power is still changing how we understand the living world. So evolution is happening today. They say tumors adapt to the drugs that initially shut them down. And they kind of explain how cancer is an evolutionary disease. So what kind of example of, what definition are they now offering for evolution? Microevolution. They go on and start offering some other sources or other arguments. They say, look, the vital force of evolution is also evident in the growing problem of antibiotic resistance. And they just love to cite this example. And again, I have no problem with, if you want to call it evolution, that's fine. But explaining how bacteria develop a resistance to antibiotics does not explain how birds arose in the first place, how tigers arose in the first place, how ferns arose in the first place, how anything did. And so this is why defining evolution is so critical. So again, any questions, comments about this whole issue of the importance of defining evolution and noticing that typically they'll offer evidences of microevolution or change over time as a justification to support this other more controversial version of evolution. Yes, sir?
You're talking about a lot of evidence of people trying to express evolution through evidence of microevolution. Have you ever seen any articles where anybody talk about the opposite, where they say, like the pill bug or the coelacanth or the alligator or the shark, which has supposedly been around for millions of years, haven't changed one bit in all that time, why they haven't evolved or changed?
Yeah, so have I seen evidence that tries to explain, or articles trying to explain why things like the shark, for example, or the cockroach, or other examples,
right,
or even some species of bats have not evolved for hundreds of millions of years?
Right.
Yes, I have. And so you're asking what explanation do they offer?
Yeah.
Well, they offer a number of different explanations. One is they say that there was simply, if there isn't enough genetic variation in their code to create new innovative morphological features, then there won't be any new features. And if there's no kind of environmental pressure that might cause some species of shark to adapt versus others to die out, then there would be no evolution of that particular species during that time. So there could be periods of stasis where species do not evolve if there's no necessarily positive, innovative genetic changes that create these new characteristics that provide an advantageous situation for the survival of an organism. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
A little bit?
It's a little eye-opening to me that we have all the evidence in front of us that there are organisms that aren't changing, and for whatever reason. So why don't people talk about that more as well?
Yeah. Well, there's an organization based out of Seattle called the Discovery Institute, and they're a pro-intelligent design advocating kind of organization, think tank. And most media, when they go to interview these people, they're like, why do you want to teach creationism in school? And they say, we're actually not advocating to teach creationism school. They're like, well, what do you want us to take out evolution? And they say, no, we don't want to take out evolution. Well, what do you want to do? We actually think that more evolution should be taught in schools. And of course, most media people are like, what? You guys are all a bunch of Christians or theists or, you know, people who believe in God. You may not be all Christians because there are, you know, Jews, Muslims, and whatever in this organization. So what do you mean you want to teach more evolution in school? Well, what they want to do is precisely what you're talking about and say, hey, look, yeah, teach evolution, but teach everything about it. Teach not only the strengths of it or the possible reasons why it might be true, but teach even the arguments or the facts that contradict the theory. So, I would agree with you that sometimes there's things that seem contrary to the general notions of how evolution works that aren't talked much about. So, what logically follows if evolution is true? What are the implications if evolution turns out to be true? And again, by the way I'm going to now start using the term evolution, I'm talking about macroevolution, so this third definition, the more controversial theory, And I'm not talking about theistic evolution, I'm talking about naturalistic evolution, meaning there is no God, and the way we arose is simply through a blind, random chance process of evolution. So if that type of evolution is true, what logically follows? Well, a number of things. The first thing is that humans would turn out to be beings that have no ultimate value. Now, why is that? What gives us value now? That's right, we're made in the image of God. It's not that our parents think we're valuable, and it's not certainly that the state gives us value. The only reason that we have any value is because we believe, as a civilization, that human beings are made in the image of God. And in fact, the Declaration of Independence even talks about this. It says, you know, we believe that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator certain unalienable rights. And so this notion of being made in the image of God not only gives human beings value, but it gives us equal value, because it's the only thing that every human being shares equally. If there was no made in the image of God, then those people who are faster than others might be considered more valuable, maybe those with a higher intelligence. But the fact is, we ground our value in something that is not a degree property. You either have the image of God or you don't, which of course you do. And so that's why it makes sense to say that human beings are valuable and are all equal value. Now, if there's no God, then we're not made in the image of God. And consequently, we would have no value. Now, you might say, well, but Alan, I would say that my son has value. Okay, sure. But that value would be simply a placebo. Because at the end of the day, you know, you're no more valuable than a swarm of mosquitoes that evolve from the same forces that human beings evolve from. In fact, before I was doing this line of work, I was a physical therapist. I used to work at a hospital, and I went to physical therapy school at Cal State University, Long Beach. And a number of my professors were atheists. One professor used to get upset with another professor that we were doing research on frogs. And she was kind of an animal rights activist, even though she was an atheist, which is a contradiction, but that's irrelevant right now. So, but she would say, you shouldn't be doing research on frogs. And so this other atheist professor would respond to her and say, it's okay that we do this because we're more, you know, important as human beings so that we can learn and study, you know, biology. So I went up to this professor and I challenged him. I said, you know, I'm interested in what you just said about human beings more valuable than frogs. I said, you're an atheist, right? He said, yeah. I said, you believe in evolution, right? He says, yeah. I said, well, evolution says that the same blind chance random forces that led to the emergence of humans also led to the emergence of frogs. So based on this accounting of how life emerged, how can you justify the claim that humans are more valuable than frogs when the same random blind chance forces led to the emergence of both? So he thought about it for a moment. He's like, oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. Don't tell the other professor I said this. But that's the reality of it. We might have value that we think we have, but in reality, we have no ultimate value. The other thing it turns out is that human beings will have no ultimate standard of morality. Because if there's no God, there is no perfect standard of morality that exists out there, independent of us human beings and of our cultures, by which we can say this action is morally good or this action is morally bad. In fact, we were talking this morning about the Nuremberg trials, where the Nazis, who were held accountable for what they did in World War II, were tried, and these were called the Nuremberg trials, and the Nazis' lawyers, in their defense, said, hey, look, we are a country, a sovereign nation, who has our own views of morality, what is right and wrong, and what should be valuable and considered worthwhile. We're not forcing those on you, the United States, or you, United Kingdom, or you, France. So you, therefore, don't force your morals on us and tell us that what we did is wrong. And if there is no God, and evolution is the way we got here, then that defense attorney is right. How can we hold them accountable for what they did? Because there's no higher standard than human standards. The only reason that we could say what they did was wrong was because the judge said, hey, look, there is a standard, there is a law that is above human law. And it is that law to which you are being held accountable. But notice, that is a law, a standard that exists over and above the earth and over and above human culture. And if evolution is the way we came here, then that does not exist, and there's no ultimate standard of morality. A third problem, or third implication of having evolution being true, is that human beings would have no soul. Now, why is this? Does anybody know why we'd have Why would it be the case that there's no soul if evolution is true?
It's chemical stuff.
That's right. The evolution is a physical process working on physical materials. The only possible product that could yield is a physical entity. And Darwin even taught, he said, look, if you accept my theory, you have to reject the notion that there is an immaterial soul that is more of who we are than just simply a physical body. Now, of course, if there's no soul, there's a good chance there's no afterlife as well. So this has radical implications for us as Christians. Also, human beings would have no free will. Now, why is this the case? We're just chemical bits of stuff, that's true, but why would that preclude us from having free will?
And when we react to the electronic stimuli that goes on.
That's right. We end up being simply a bunch of electronic stimuli, and if we're purely a physical object, then we just simply respond to the laws of chemistry and physics, right? I mean, think about it for a moment. Just imagine a billiard ball. Does a billiard ball, which is an entirely physical object, does it have the ability, as it's rolling, to freely decide to stop rolling in one direction and then turn in another direction? The answer is no, right? Yeah. Billiard balls can't do that. At least I've never seen one do that. Take something more complex. Take a stapler. Does a stapler, which is more complex than a billiard ball but still a physical object, does it have the ability for free will? No. Even though it's got more moving parts, but still, it simply acts based on the physics, the forces of physics that bear upon it. Okay? Take something more complex, like an automobile. An automobile is also a purely physical object. Does it have the ability of free will? No, it doesn't. I mean, it might seem like it can... Everything, yeah, my car does freely choose to swerve and shut off when I don't want it to. But you realize, though, at the end of the day, that even the engine works based on the laws of physics and chemistry, on chemicals burning, oxygen and gasoline mixing, there's ignition, all these things. It's purely a physical object, complex, but at the end of the day, it can only operate based on the pre-existing states of physics and chemistry. So it has no potential for free will. By the way, as I've gone from a billiard ball to a stapler to a car, has the potential for free will gotten any better? No. Okay. So take something now more complex. How about a computer? Does a computer have the ability to have free will? Now, some of your computers might. You might think. That's why we want to punch them sometimes. But the reality is also no. We can program a computer with certain human input to make it appear like it's freely choosing, but at the end of the day, it simply operates based on pre-existing laws of physics and chemistry. And so if you just then go one more step to a human being, and if we were to assume that we are also just a physical object, then you cannot in any way account for free will if we're just a physical object. Because at the end of the day, just like the computer, the car, the stapler, the billiard ball, we are entirely physical objects that are governed by pre-existing laws of chemistry, or pre-existing states of chemistry and physics that bear upon our minds, our brains, I should say. There's really no mind. In fact, Stephen Hawking, the great astrophysicist, he recently came out the book, what is it called? The Great Quantum Leap? I can't believe I forgot his name of the book. But anyways, he just came out this year, I think, with this book. And in his book, he even argues, he says, free will is an illusion. If we are purely physical, free will is an illusion. And well-known Darwinists fully admit this when they're being honest. And of course, this raises a lot of questions, right? I mean, if people don't really have free will, how can you hold someone accountable for committing a crime? I mean, there's all sorts of things that would be nonsensical that we normally believe in as human beings. So again, these are the implications of what evolution would entail if it was true. Okay, just to give you a little understanding. Now, I want to briefly give you two reasons why I'm not an evolutionist. Okay, and you might think, well, you know, how can anyone really respond to evolution? This seems like such an overwhelming task. Because evolution as an idea touches on all sorts of disciplines, right? Geology, chemistry, physics, biology, microbiology, paleontology, genetics. How can anyone possibly know all there is to know about all those subjects when they speak on evolution. It's impossible, and it is impossible, not just for me, but even for committed Darwinists who are PhDs in any particular field. They can't be experts in everything. And so what we've done, really, at Standard Reason, is we've tried to say, well, look, what are two essential pillars of evolution that must be true in order for evolution to be true? And we believe abiogenesis, which I'll define, and transitional forms, also which I'll define, are two essential components that have to be true, that have to exist and be real. And if one of them is not true, or if both of them, then evolution cannot be true, because these are essential features of the theory. So let's take each one of these in turn. First, abiogenesis. What is abiogenesis? Well, before we can answer what abiogenesis is, let's define what biogenesis is. Biogenesis is simply the idea that life comes from pre-existing life. Okay? So usually we say, look, dogs, when they produce another dog. You know, tigers produce another tiger. And if you go back enough, you always have life coming from pre-existing life. So abiogenesis would be life coming from non-life. And for evolution, macroevolution, to be true, this following story has to be true. And that is, at one point in the history of the Earth, nothing living existed. All there was dirt, water, mountains, snow, whatever. But nothing living, no plant, no animal lived. And then, somehow, the first cell emerged. The first cell of life, perhaps a bacteria is what they believe it was. And that jump from nothing living to the first living cell is the jump of is abiogenesis, creating the first life from no life. Now, this is an insurmountable task, even from an evolutionary perspective, but they have to believe that this happened. This is an essential component to Darwinian evolution. And what they believe is that there was this stuff called prebiotic soup, this organic soup of a rich mixture of organic compounds and molecules that was sitting in the oceans, perhaps frozen in ice, but that existed somewhere on the Earth, and it contained all the building blocks to create the first cell. And somehow, by chance, these building blocks eventually formed the first living cell. And this is the step of abiogenesis, or some people call it spontaneous generation. Now, this question has been studied, and even the most current issue of evolution is raising this question, and they really don't have any good answers. There's merely speculation, because the notion that you can go from nothing living to the first life is a huge, huge step that really puzzles even the best scientists in the world. Now, the reason why there's no good reason to think this has happened is because, first of all, there's no evidence for this notion of the prebiotic soup. In fact, evolutionists themselves kind of joke amongst themselves when they're writing in these journals to say, you know, as much as prebiotic soup is talked about, there's really no good evidence that it ever existed. You know, we simply have to assume that it did, but we can't prove it. But even if there was this prebiotic soup, even if there was this stuff, this rich mixture of organic compounds that could assemble a cell, again, by chance, by itself, without any direction, a bigger problem is the fact that a single cell, even the most simplest bacterial cell, is so complex that it's just unfathomable to think that it arose by chance. And so if you looked at a picture or studied biology, you would come to appreciate how complex a cell is. This picture does not do the concept justice. But in the days of Darwin, they didn't have strong electron microscopes that could look inside a cell. And they thought cells were just like a blob of jello. In fact, in Darwin, a cell was like a black box, which gives the reason for the title of that one book, Darwin's Black Box, if you've heard of that book. But he just thought it was a blob of jello, and many of the scientists thought the same thing. They thought, well, a cell could arise by chance because it's not very complex. However, with the advent of modern technology and scanning electron microscopes, we now have the ability to peer into a cell and see how complex it is. And so actually, as we've progressed in our scientific abilities and moved forward, it seems now that we have more and more reason to think that there is an intelligent designer, which I'll get to explaining later. But contrary to the way people think, They think, oh, well, as science has progressed, we have now more reason to think that God doesn't exist and that evolution does, or is real. But I think the opposite's true. The more science has advanced, the more ability we have to understand how complex nature really is. Anyways, this picture doesn't do us justice. If you're interested, you might consider something like The Mystery of Life's Origins, or Unlocking the Mystery of Life's Origin, which is a great DVD that illustrates the complexities of the cell. But if you listen to what molecular biologist Michael Denton, he's an Australian, says about studying the cell. Listen to what he says. Microbiology has shown that even the simplest of all living systems on Earth today, bacterial cells, are exceedingly complex objects. Although the tiniest bacterial cells are incredibly small, each is in effect a veritable micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery made up altogether of 100,000 million atoms, far more complicated than any machine built by man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. I mean, they say, you know, these cells are as complex as the city of Los Angeles, yet they can duplicate themselves in like 20 minutes. It's just phenomenal technology. The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it is impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle. And Harold Klein, who's the chairman of the National Academy of Sciences, again, a pro-evolution, pro-atheist organization, says the simplest bacterium is so damn complicated from the point of a view of a chemist that it is almost impossible to imagine how it happened. And so this is the problem they face. They face, you know, how do they explain how a cell could just emerge by chance? Now, two scientists, again, atheists, evolutionists, try to calculate the probability of having all the parts of a cell arise by chance. And they spent a whole book. It's hundreds of pages long. It's by Fred Hoyle, who's a Nobel Prize winner, and his partner, Chandra Wickramasinghe. And listen to how they figured out the calculation to be. They said the probability of assembling just one of the simplest life forms is only one part in 10^20^2000, which is 10^40,000 power, which is an outrageously small probability that could not be faced even if the whole universe consisted of organic soup. Again, this is the testimony of committed evolutionists and atheists, not some Christians who are just trying to disprove evolution. They themselves are telling you that the probabilities are just insurmountable.
Isn't that more than the total number of atoms in the universe?
It might be, but there's actually a number, there's like a number like 300 something power, where once it gets to that improbability, then you consider it impossible. Well, this goes beyond that. You know, and just to numbers that are still staggering, it's not even worth trying to consider what numbers we're looking at. So what do evolutionists conclude then based on these improbabilities? Well, listen to what evolutionist George Wald says. He says, you know, one has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation, or the abiogenesis, of a living organism is impossible. Yet, here we are, as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation.
Is that the suicide?
Yeah, this is like a suicide. So it's impossible to think once you understand how impossible this is. But you know what? We're here, aren't we? So it must have happened. That's exactly what he's saying. Francis Crick, who, if any of you know, won the Nobel Prize because he discovered DNA. This is, again, evolutionist, committed atheist. And listen to what he says about this problem. He says, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life, meaning abiogenesis, appears to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. Yeah, almost a miracle. That's right. Of course, you can't say it was a miracle. So again, there isn't sufficient, this is reason why, based on the testimony of evolutionists themselves, why I don't buy into abiogenesis. Because they're the ones telling me it probably didn't happen. So what's their explanation then? Well, they've offered many different ideas. Sir Fred Hoyle, actually, again, a Nobel Prize winner, has suggested the idea of panspermia. Does anybody know what panspermia is?
A lot of sperm.
It isn't about... yes, I guess it does mean a lot of sperm, but...
Indiscriminate father.
No, yes, sir? Yeah.
It came from outer space. Right?
Yeah, it came from outer space. They believe that the origin of life, DNA, the complexity of the cell, must have been seeded from life. And sometimes they'll say directed panspermia, which means that alien life seeded our planet with the particles that were needed to create life on Earth.
And where did they get?
Well, that's right. Well, that's a great point. By the way, the movie Mission to Mars, it was put out, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, is actually a movie which makes this case. It's a movie about how they go to Mars and they find this alien life form and then they discover that it had seeded our planet and caused it to undergo the process of evolution.
What's their proof for that?
Well, good question. But there's a bigger problem with this idea. If I don't answer your question, just come back to it. I'm not trying to avoid it. Let me just finish this thought. The problem with panspermia, this is actually something you alluded to. Well, there's a number of problems. First of all, this idea concedes that the idea of abiogenesis is absurd. They realize it couldn't have happened just by chance. They have to explain it somehow, so they posit this other idea. But notice, now this explanation is no longer a naturalistic evolution. It's like a kind of God-guided evolution. There must have been some intelligence that seeded our planet. So notice how now they're abandoning this idea that, oh, it must have just happened by chance. Well, no, it couldn't have. There's got to be some intelligent life that seeded the planet. Of course, it's not God, but it must have been an alien, right, is the way they do it. And as you pointed out, this just pushes the problem of abiogenesis back one step further. Because now we have to ask the question, well, wait a minute. Those aliens on their planet, how do they evolve by chance? There must have been abiogenesis there. Well, maybe an alien seeded that planet too. Well, you can't go back forever. This is an infinite regress. So this is the state that they're in with regards to abiogenesis. Okay, so that's the first pillar. Abiogenesis doesn't have sufficient evidence to warrant belief, and that alone would be enough in my book, and this is why I'm not an evolutionist, because I don't see the evidence for abiogenesis by the testimony of evolutionists themselves, which is why I don't believe in it, okay? But we can look at the other pillar, that is transitional forms. And again, another essential component that's necessary if evolution is going to be true. Now, what are transitional forms? Well, this is what's known, or some people like it to, a tree of life. So, oh, that's right, my pointer doesn't work on the screen. At the very bottom, you have the first single-celled organism. This is the first progenitor of all of life. And then you can see it breaks off onto the right, and you see the plant kingdom and all the plants and trees. And then kind of to the left, up in the top to the left, is, you know, mammals and vertebrates and all kinds of other animal kingdom species. Now, in between that first dot at the bottom, that first precursor to all of life, precursor and to every species that you see depicted there, there are transitional forms. These are species that are kind of in between, say, a fish and a frog. Okay? Because between fish and frogs, there must have been these small changes for a fish to eventually evolve into a frog. Well, all those intermediate forms are referred to as transitional forms. And of course, there has to be transitional forms that occur between every two species that have an ancestor-descendant relationship. So these transitions also would take thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years to take place. So you can imagine, between just a fish and a frog, it may have taken a million or so years for this evolutionary steps to take. So there's probably millions of these transitional forms just between a fish and a frog. That would mean that there's also millions of transitions between every living and extinct species that exists on the planet, for every animal, for every plant. So the number of transitional forms would be just a crazy, crazy number. In fact, in the Buddha's book on the origin of species, Charles Darwin even stated this. So if you read his book, he'll say, the number of intermediate and transitional links, this is what he's talking about, these transitional forms, between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory be true, such have lived upon the earth. So he's saying, look, if my theory is true, that there's all these transitional forms, we should find millions upon millions of these transitions between every two species that are connected or related. By the way, notice that if you read The Origin of Species or if you read any of Darwin's books, he's a very fair and actually reasonable person. Why? Because look, he offers ways to test if his theory is true or false, which is quite unlike many evolutionists that I talked to today. There's no way you could falsify the theory. There's no possibility. But yet even Darwin himself, time and time again, says, hey, look, if you want to disprove my theory, here's what you should find. Or you know what? This is a major, major problem with my theory. And if this is not resolved, my theory is not true. He says this quite often in his book. Now, one of his chief disciples, his name is T.H. Huxley. They called him Darwin's bulldog because he was such a vocal proponent of Darwinian theory, acknowledged that in their time, about 150 years ago, there wasn't much evidence for transitional forms. And so he said this. He says, if it could be shown that this fact, these gaps, the fact that there's no transitional forms, had always existed, this fact would be fatal to the doctrine of evolution. And so, you know, he recognized that this is a problem for their theory, but they thought, well, you know, maybe in the future we'll get more transitional forms and this will prove our theory. Darwin said the same thing. In fact, he cited the lack of transitional forms as a major problem against his theory. He said, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such these intermediate links? This is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Again, very reasonable person. You know, here he's saying, look, there aren't a lot of examples of these transitional forms, so this doesn't fare well for my theory. But this was 150 years ago. Maybe now that there's been 150 years of digging around in the geological record, maybe we've unearthed a lot more transitional forms. So maybe there's more good news now. Unfortunately for Darwinists, no. In fact, University of Chicago professor of geology, David Bropp, summarizes the situation now. He says, look, we're now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. But the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. Again, this is not a Christian. This is a committed evolutionist. G.G. Simpson, perhaps the greatest paleontologist of the 20th century. In fact, he was noted to be probably the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century. Harvard paleontologist, of course, PhD, cited this problem as well recently. He said, look, this regular absence of transitional forms is not confined just to mammals, but is an almost a universal phenomenon, as has long been noted by paleontologists. So he's saying, look, there aren't these transitional forms, not just amongst mammals, but virtually every species. We don't see this slow, gradual transition from a fish to a frog or from a dinosaur to a bird or whatever the transition is. And it's been long noted, it's been long understood and noted by paleontologists. These are the very people who study this particular thing. After he passed away, Stephen Jay Gould was perhaps the next most prominent paleontologist, also Harvard-trained paleontologist, well-known. Very, very well respected. He said the same thing. All paleontologists, it's a pretty broad, pretty strong statement, know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt. So when they say they're abrupt, or when they say that they're surprisingly jerky, they mean you have a fish, you have a frog, but you don't see any kind of slow transition. It's abrupt. You see fishes, then you see frogs. You see dinosaurs, and then you see birds, but you don't see the slow transition. That's what they mean by abrupt or jerky. So this picture that I showed you earlier, where you have these nice smooth lines, and all those lines represent all these transitional forms, if you were to now redraw this based on the fossil record that we have today, it would look like this. There would be none of those lines missing. You just see that at some point, these species appear in the fossil record with no slow, gradual, transitional forms for them. Now, people say, but Alan, you know what? There are some supposed transitional forms, like Archaeopteryx, you know? A lot of Darwinists are pointing to this dinosaur slash bird transition as evidence, you know? And so they draw them out and they say, see, you can tell It looks like a dinosaur, but you can tell it's got feathers, so this is probably a transitional form from dinosaurs to birds. Now, my thought is, okay, possibly, but even evolutionists think that this is a very controversial theory to suggest that this is a transitional form. For the most part, it could also just be an extinct bird. Who says it has to be a transitional form? We don't know that. It's not like you dig this bird up and it says, okay, I'm transitioning from a dinosaur to a bird. All right, that isn't listed in there in their bone structure, or in the fossils. And really what's happening here is they've accepted evolution as fact first, and then now they're simply looking for confirming examples that will verify their theory. Rather, if they just took the evidence on itself without having this already preconceived notion, it's probably wouldn't be the case that they would reach the same conclusion. They also cite Ambulocetus, which is a transition between a four-footed land-dwelling mammal to a whale, because this is how they believe the transition went. First, there was like a deer-like animal, and then it eventually evolved into the water, okay, and became whales and dolphins. Okay, so this is their story. And they think Ambulocetus is an example of this transitional form. Now, again, I could probably cite maybe 12, maybe 15. Let's just say I could cite 50 to 100 examples of what they believe to be examples of transitional forms, or they posit that. I still wouldn't be convinced, and here's why. Evolution, remember, posits this idea that there is a worldwide continuum of change between all living and extinct species. If that was the case, there should be millions and millions of transitional forms being found everywhere. The fact that we're dealing with just a handful of possible candidates is significant counter evidence to the idea that transitional forms, as an idea, is a legitimate concept and is borne out by the scientific evidence. And that's my concern. This is why I'm not convinced, because according to their own testimony, as these top evolutionists say, transitional forms don't exist like what we suppose they were supposed to. And this is a big problem. So any questions about transitional forms and the evidence and kind of what my conclusion is in terms of why I don't accept it? Anything that puzzled you or wasn't clear?
You haven't talked about human beings. There's been a lot of so-called transitional forms there.
Yeah, I didn't talk about human beings. So, like, you have all the bipedal hominids that have existed in the past. We dig them up, like Lucy. And so I haven't talked about them. That's true, I haven't. That's because we only have a few hours to cover just some basics, and so I'm covering a broad view. But with regards to bipedal hominids, the question is, well, do they represent transitional forms of human beings? Well, they do if you accept evolution to be true. But if you don't accept evolution to be true outright and then look for confirming examples, you can just suppose that these bipedal hominids are extinct animals. Like the vast majority of species that have gone extinct in the past, bipedal hominids are also just extinct animals. I mean, why should we be surprised that there would be other animals that walk on two legs? I mean, I don't see why this is like a big shock to us. So if you just look at the evidence by itself, without some sort of preconceived idea of what the evidence should say, then you would just simply look at this animal and say, well, this is an animal that once lived and is now extinct, like thousands and millions of other species that were once alive and now are extinct as well. So again, to say, well, we found this animal that's shorter than a human, but taller than an ape, or you know, whatever, and then to say, so therefore it's a transitional form, this is not a scientific theory. In fact, Henry Gee, who's the chief science writer for Nature, he's an evolutionist, he's an atheist, he even says, to take a line of fossils and to put them in this like transitional form where you have, you know, an ape going from, or you know, this ape-like creature and kind of evolving up to a human, to take a line of fossils like this and to say that this is that these fossils have a descendant-ancestor relationship to one another is a bedtime story, he calls it. He said it might be amusing, but it's not scientific. And again, he says no fossil is buried with his birth certificate that tells us, oh, well, this is related to this one and this is related. These are just all assumptions that they make because they first accepted evolution as a fact and then later looking for examples to prove their theory and to put these fossils in there. So that's my general take on those issues, but again, the reason why I didn't address it in detail is just because of our limited time. Good. Any other comments, thoughts? Yes, sir.
How do evolutionists bring in those laws of thermodynamics that reveal not a force for life and improvement and transition, but always a force toward decay? If you apply enough heat, there will always be decay.
Mm-hmm. Well, bringing up the idea of the second law of thermodynamics that in a closed system everything moves towards an increasing disorder to entropy.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is brought up, I know, by a lot of Christians, but I don't think it's a good argument. And the reason why I don't think it's a good argument or critique against evolution is because, first of all, this is a second law of thermodynamics of heat, and this isn't necessarily an issue with heat because Christians will say, well, see, you have an increasing order. You're having from disorder to order, but thermodynamics works the opposite way. That's true, but that only matters when it comes to hot and cold particles. Also, it only happens in a closed system, and the Earth is not a closed system. So you have the infusion of energy from stars, from the sun, into the Earth that can infuse with energy. So, I mean, even my assessment as a person who doesn't believe in evolution, I don't think that this is a good argument against evolutionary theory, because the second law of thermodynamics wouldn't apply in this manner, since it's not a closed system. You have outside forces, and really you're dealing with hot and cold particles. So, if we walked into a closed room and saw a hot cup of coffee sitting on the table, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that hot cup of coffee has not been there for an eternity, because if it had, it would have cooled down and reach an equilibrium with everything in the room. But that only holds true in a closed system, and the Earth is not closed. So this is why you can have increasing order in a situation on Earth with evolution. Again, I don't think evolution is true, but I'm just saying I don't think this is a good argument against that. Does that make sense? A little bit? You want to follow up with a clarifying question, or are you okay so far? Okay. Now, if the evidence for transitional forms is this bad, then why wouldn't these people, these Harvard-trained paleontologists, then abandon the idea? What do they then say if there isn't any evidence and this is what they're telling us? Well, they have suggested this idea of, and this is only some evolutionists, idea of punctuated equilibria. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould, who I cited, the Harvard paleontologist, he died a few years ago, prematurely. But he is one of the main advocates of this idea of punctuated equilibria. And here's the idea in a nutshell. See, normally evolution says that you have a slow transition from one species to another over millions of years, and so you should have all these fossils. But of course, we don't see all those fossils, so maybe what happened is this, and that is that this species remained the same for maybe thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, and then in a short time period, jumped and became some other species. But that transitional period only lasted maybe 10,000 or 100,000 years, a very short period of time in geological years. And as a result, there wasn't enough time for any of these transitional forms to become fossilized in the geological record, because the transition happened so quick. So you have a species remaining the same for millions of years, and all of a sudden it changes rather rapidly and then stays the same again. No changes in its morphology. And so that period of change is so short. This is why they call it punctuated equilibria. Lots of stasis, lots of no change, and then all of a sudden that stasis is punctuated with a lot of change. Now, what's interesting about this belief is that, first of all, it is a concession that the evidence for transitional forms is not there, right? Because they're saying, okay, it's not there, so how do we account for this? So they're conceding our point. But second of all, many Darwinists don't even agree with this idea. And they don't agree with it based on scientific grounds. And here's why. You see, in order for any organism, any species to evolve, it has to have genetic mutations. And what do we know about most genetic mutations? They're harmful, right? When you think of mutation, you think of like an extra appendage sticking out of your body that doesn't have a fully functioning form, right? This wouldn't help an organism survive. It would make it more vulnerable, right? I mean, if my leg was coming out of my hip this way, you know, I'm more likely to die and be eaten by a cheetah or, you know, some other animal. So the vast majority of mutations are unfavorable. In order for punctuated equilibria to work, you would have to have a lot of positive mutations in a very short period of time. And of course, that is just wildly unlikely according to scientific research that evolutionists give us. So that's the concern with that alternative explanation. So why I'm not an evolutionist? Well, because the two pillars that are essential for evolution to be true do not have enough evidence to warrant support, in my opinion. Okay? Abiogenesis is seemingly impossible, and the evidence for transitional forms by the testimony of evolutionists themselves is not present. I mean, they're no longer arguing this anymore. So I'm going to take them at face value and believe what they say with regards to this, and this is why I don't believe in evolution. So we're going to take a break in a minute and then jump into the case for intelligent design. But is there any other questions or comments or concerns regarding this first material before we take a break? Yes?
I was wondering, in that first cell that's believed to have formed, are you including DNA in that? Because just recently I read that DNA further blows that whole thing because those cells are programmed. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, we'll talk about this a little bit in the second section, but when I talked about that first cell, I did not address the additional complexities of the biologic, of the, I should say, like you said, programming, the information that's present in DNA. But I will talk about that in the second section. But the question really is that calculation of one part in 10 to the 400 thousandths or whatever, does that factor in the complexities of DNA? I do not know. But either way, it's still an impossibility. If it does include it, okay, fine. If it doesn't, okay, fine. Either way, the numbers are so off the charts that it's no rational human being should accept it, that that possibility actually happened. Yes?
How does a, and maybe you don't know because you don't believe this view, but do you have any idea how an evolutionist who believes in panspermia would, I guess, how they would resolve the problem of now adding a whole new ecosystem that needs evolution to a system that science itself says is not an eternal universe but has a set time that it's been in existence. And so how do they address the fact that now you've added a significant amount of further evolution that needs to take place in the same finite amount of time? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, for evolutionists who suggest panspermia, I mean, some of them do so seriously and some do not. And you're right, they just simply, it's just pushing the problem one step further. But they would just simply argue that, you know, whatever evolutionary forces occurred, or whatever we know about evolutionary forces and how they occur on Earth, probably just occurred on an alien planet, but in perhaps in a more hospitable kind of situation. So they realize on Earth that the conditions maybe aren't the best or ideal, so maybe evolution first happened somewhere else, and then since later we were seeded, the hard work was already done. But they see evolution as a process that's going to happen no matter what, almost. It's just a matter of kind of giving it the necessary jumpstart conditions to make it happen. By the way, with regards to the claim that you made about how most scientists accept that, you know, the universe had a finite beginning, what we're seeing now is actually that this whole Big Bang cosmology, which many people thought originally was atheistic, you know, we see as very theistic, right? If there's a Big Bang, there must have been a Big Banger, right? And so a lot of scientists, you know, they want to shy away from this notion because they realize the theistic implications. And so now they're positing, you know, expanding and contracting universes, multiple universes, and they're doing everything to avoid this clear, distinct beginning. Even that can't be assumed that scientists would agree with that. So that's just another factor to throw in. Yes, sir?
Do you think that
You've told us what you are not, but not what you are. Are you a progressive creationist? And if you are, how often do you see these progressive creations occurring over Earth history?
I haven't said what I'm not. I'm not an evolutionist, but I haven't stated what I am. I guess I don't speak much on sort of my view of creation, like how did creation happen. This is not something I typically teach on. I'm more of offering a critique of naturalistic evolution, as I see that as a common enemy that young Earth, old Earth, progressive creations, all these people have. Only because I don't like to get into really divisive issues amongst Christians about, you know, how creation happened. But just to throw it out there, I tend to be an old Earth creationist, as they would say. So I agree with the scientific data that says the universe is old. But I believe in the historical Adam and Eve, and I believe in special creation and all that. So I tend to think that I stick very, very closely to what Scripture teaches. But I will say that I'm sympathetic towards the young Earth position. Sometimes I might say, well, 4 days out of the week I'm an old Earth creationist, and 3 days I'm a young Earth creationist. You just caught me on the wrong day, sort of thing. But so I don't know. Does that answer your view or your question?
No, but I don't want to belabor it.
Oh, well,
just to take one of the transitional fossil.
Hold on. Before you go into the fossil thing, I didn't answer your question. You said that you wanted to know what I am.
You were a progressive creationist.
Well, how do you define progressive creationist?
One who apparently, and I'm throwing this out,
sure,
believes that there were creative intrusions into the process at various times in the past.
I'm leery of saying I'm a progressive creationist only because I don't know what else that title entails. But I fully believe that God supernaturally created life on Earth. Adam and Eve, He created fully formed. He did not evolve them. This is my view. So I guess that would be kind of a progressive creationist view, because
I don't want to
sure.
believe this.
Sorry, sure.
But take one of those fossil chains,
yes,
of creatures.
Yes.
If you don't see those as evolutionarily related to each other,
right,
then how did they come to be?
Well, how did these extinct species that,
yes,
appear to be transitional forms,
yes,
how did they come to be? Well, I would just say that they came to be the same way that any animal came to be. We have, for example, the Cambrian explosion, which I think is, what, 530 million years ago? Or 53 million years ago? 530 million? Yeah, okay, so I knew it was one of those numbers. Just add a zero or subtract a zero. But so what you see is a massive emergence of, you know, thousands of species all appearing in the fossil record without any kind of evolutionary transition leading up to them. So, I mean, to me, if you just accept the evidence and say, well, okay, let's follow the evidence where it leads, it seems to be that God supernaturally created life forms at a certain time in the history of the Earth.
Surely the descendants, what are being called descendants,
yeah,
of whales, don't date back to the Cambrian explosion.
No. So, I mean, I don't study creation, so this is a little bit out of my field of expertise. I haven't studied how I would make sense of how creation happened. But I'm fully comfortable with the idea that God supernaturally created creatures fully formed at points in the past. That's what the fossil record seems to suggest. That's why I would accept it. And of course, the Bible teaches it as well. It looks like he created Adam and Eve as adults, fully formed. So I don't see why that's a problem. I mean, if you accept a God that can create the universe ex nihilo, out of nothing, to create a species on Earth is nothing. It's child's play. Yes, ma'am.
So if the Earth is changing, you know, from beginning to now, I mean, could be changing, wouldn't that give reason for why the animals are changing? Because they need to adapt to their, not necessarily evolve, but adapt to their differing surroundings?
Absolutely. I have no problem with believing that animals are able to adapt to their surroundings. Again, that's a microevolutionary change. And
right.
Again, we see this with bacteria, we see this with rats, we see this with rabbits whose fur can change over time, we see this with finches whose beaks become larger to adapt to the environment. But this is just adaptation within a species. We don't see the species becoming something else. You know, so yeah, I'm fully comfortable with the idea that any species can adapt within its environment.
So then possibly with these fossils as well, could still be the same species, but they're adapting and they're surrounding.
Oh, which fossils?
These
alleged transitional forms?
Yes, alleged.
Yeah, but I don't even see those as adapting. I just see them as a unique species. I mean, just like we have dogs and we have dolphins,
sure.
that Archaeopteryx could have just been another animal that was created by God, you know, like the millions of other species that were created. So, but can they adapt within their own species? Sure. But we wouldn't see this, we wouldn't see a dinosaur becoming a bird, or we wouldn't see a fish becoming a frog, you know. Yes?
I wanted to try to take a stab at clarifying Ms. Jones' question.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He can correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah.
But I think the question was, would you believe in creative periods? So if certain things were created, and then maybe 5 million years later, 10 million years later, certain things were created. So there's no transitional forms,
right.
But these are unique things within creative periods that God said, okay, now I'm going to create humans, but these other things existed for millions of years, some things
uh-huh.
happen for a short
sure.
time, and then other things.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be comfortable with this idea that God created a certain time and then maybe paused and then created other things later. For example, maybe he created smaller life forms originally, such that they could live and die for millions of years and nutrient the Earth's crust, such that by the time that larger species came by, there would be a hospitable, sustainable planet ecosystem that could maintain larger life like human beings and elephants and dogs. So I'd be open to that. I think actually that's the view that Hugh Ross takes at Reasons to Believe. And I don't know if that's a bad word in this church, but sometimes the name Hugh Ross is a four-letter word. So I'm not trying to upset anybody. I'm not actually here trying to advocate any view of creation. I'm now just sort of bantering with you guys and talking about possibilities of creation. My concern, again, is the larger issue, which is our common enemy, and that is naturalistic evolution. Mm-hmm. So how God created and stuff, I'm open to being convinced of a particular idea. Yes, sir?
Do you believe the Earth is billions of years old or millions of years old?
Yeah, so as an old Earth creationist, I would believe that the universe is about 14.6 billion years and the Earth is 4.3 or 3 point whatever they say.
You don't think God could have done it in 6 days?
Yeah, certainly. I do believe he could have. In fact, I'm sympathetic to that view. As I was saying, I'm 3 days out of the week, I think that the Earth is younger. 4 days out of the week, I think it's older. In other words, I'm not decided on it. I'm not sure. But yes, God create the Earth in 6 days. In fact, he can create it in a second. He doesn't need any time. He could not even, you know, blink, and everything is created. So it's not a matter of time that he needs. The question is what did he end up doing? And, I have many friends who are young Earth creationists who believe that the Earth is just a few thousand years old. And I'm fully willing to accept their evidence if they can provide me with the compelling evidence that that's the case. Yes, sir, in the back.
What is the argument that with the transitional forms that the evolutionists give as to if there's like short spurts of start out as a bacteria, now you're a human being. If that's the case, why aren't we seeing that all the time? So what's their argument against, you know, like having things crawl out of the lake in our, and, you know.
Right. What's the argument? Why is it then that we don't
because
see things?
Because there should be, if that's the case, there should be constant transitional forms
sure.
in all periods and not just
yeah.
a spurt here and a spurt there. It should just be a constant.
Yeah, if evolution is true, shouldn't there be a constant evolutionary change amongst all species even now? And the answer is, or they would answer, yes, and it is changing. See, look at bacteria. Look at these birds, their finches, the beaks. So we are seeing the constant evolutionary transition of all sorts of species. There are periods of stasis where there's no changes, And that's because if there's no environmental pressure that forces a creature or a species to adapt and change, then it won't. But because we are artificially creating a hostile environment for some bacteria, they are developing resistance and they're evolving.
So I understand that, but what I'm asking is, you said that there are people that believe that there might have been 10,000 or 1,000 year spurts of massive change.
Yes.
Why aren't we seeing that now? What's their argument against
that?
Well,
the people who say these punctuated equilibria advocates, that's what I was trying to say, is that they do say there we do see change. But if right now we're not seeing a lot of change, they would just say it's because we're in a period of stasis. If right now the Earth was to undergo a rapid change in its climate change, an ice age, right? There would be large numbers of human beings that would die off, and those humans that have certain characteristics that give them an ability to tolerate extreme weather, would survive, and they would see this as an evolutionary transition, because eventually they would reproduce. Those who have maybe thicker skin or have more body fat or whatever it might be, Eskimos.
But they'd still be humans.
Of course, they'd still be humans, right? But they would argue that given enough time, there'll be something else.
But that is a trait that's already present. It's not a newly created trait.
Correct, but with genetic mutations, if we had a genetic mutations occur in our bodies because of maybe solar flares or whatever, then that might create a new appendage, a new feature of our bodies that has that gives us an advantage to survive in, say, extreme heat. Well, then that characteristic could then be passed on to the next generation. So you're right. Normally, we're just talking about existing traits. But where do these traits come from? They would say through genetic mutations. So let's say we are going towards global warming. And let's say it's going to be really, really, really hot. And a quarter of the world's population, or let's just say 10,000 humans, get this one genetic mutation that allows them to tolerate extreme heat. The rest of the world dies off. Those 10,000 survive, they reproduce, and those 10,000 pass on that one genetic mutation in their genetic codes to their children. And so then maybe there's another mutation, and that mutation allows another 5,000 to survive in another sort of condition, and the rest of them die off. And so they just see how this adds on itself? This is the story that they give. I'm not saying true, but that's just the story they give.
Exactly, yeah. Because they're saying all these positive traits continue to add up, and that doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense if those positive traits continue to add up.
That's right, and I'll explain towards the end of the second section here as to why they insist on this. There's actually something else driving this more than science. So let's take a break, because we're at our break time, and then we'll come back in about 5 or 10 minutes and hit our argument for the evidence for intelligent design.